It's really great to have the opportunity to talk about this material with you. It's something I'm fascinated in, and the hardest part was cutting down the material to an amount that might fit within this time period. Also, everybody I met outside, a few people there, everybody was a scientist. But I'm not assuming that anybody is a scientist. So this talk is for everybody, including people that know nothing a priori about science. And I encourage you completely to feel totally free to ask whatever question you want to ask. There are no dumb questions. And I'm willing and happy to just stop and talk about that instead of my prepared material. So a century of black holes, this is a perfect year to talk about this. The century refers to the year 1915, which is when Einstein completed his theory of general relativity. Here's a picture of Einstein when he was a patent clerk in Bern in 1905. That was his miracle year when he published three revolutionary papers in three different fields of physics. What he had to say about working at the patent office instead of at the KITP or at a university was a practical profession as a salvation for a man of my type. An academic career compels a young man to scientific production, and only strong characters can resist the temptation of superficial analysis. He was not a man of superficial analysis. After those revolutionary papers, he continued to work in the patent office. It wasn't until, I think, 1909 that he got his first academic position. And in 1907, he started thinking about the problem of gravity. So something you may not know, everybody's heard of the theory of relativity. There are really theories, two basic theories of relativity that are quite distinct. The first one is what he came up with in 1905, that's called special relativity. And 1915 finally completed general relativity, but he started thinking about this in 1907. So it was a long period of deep and patient thought. So what does special relativity have to do with? The key statements from it are the concept of simultaneity in time, two things happening at the same time, has actually no absolute meaning. I'm not going to have a chance to explain all these things. I'm just giving you the backdrop here. Another thing is that the speed of light is the same for all observers. You can't chase down a light beam. It's going to go at the speed of light no matter how fast you're running. And of course, the famous equation E equals mc squared came out of that piece of work that states that energy, that mass is a form of energy. And finally, in 1915, he completed the general relativity theory, which was the point of which was to include gravity into this scheme. And the conclusion was gravity is the curvature of space-time. And I'll actually try to explain that point in a moment. And light rays bend, they don't go in straight lines. And what might really be the most basic and alarming statement, and really is the central statement of the whole theory, is that the rate that time flows depends on where you are in a gravitational field. So let me explain a little bit about that. We should start with Newton. This picture is enormous when I put it here, but that's okay. He was an enormous intellect. He was 46 years old when that portrait was done in 1689. Gravity is a force of attraction between any two masses, and it's the strength of it is proportional to the mass and inversely proportional to the square of the separation. So it's stronger when bodies are closer and stronger for larger masses. And with this theory, he unified the falling of an apple, the ocean tides, and the orbits of the moon and the planets, all into one simple scheme that was captured by a single law of universal gravitational attraction. And it was that law that Einstein needed to modify to make it consistent with special relativity theory. So here's a portrait of Einstein. Actually, let's say, what is it? 5 years after he started thinking about the problem and 3 years before he finally got the final form. He was 33 in this portrait. So here I'm going to make an attempt in one slide to explain what it means to say that gravity is the curvature of space-time. And let's just begin by thinking about something more familiar. This is should be visualized like a round sphere, like the Earth. This could be the equator. And these dashed lines are lines of longitude. And what it's showing is that if you start out walking north from the equator, you'll eventually end up at the North Pole. And that's true no matter which point on the equator you start at. So if you take two lines that are near each other, both headed due north, that's like two parallel lines. And indeed, they actually meet at the North Pole. And the fact that parallel lines don't remain parallel is a sign of the fact that the surface of the globe is curved and not flat. That's what it means to be curved. So how can we think of gravity as curvature of space-time? The key is that the surface in which we think of that includes time as a dimension. So here's a picture. It's called a space-time diagram. Time is this dimension going up this way. And space is the sideways dimensions. Space is three-dimensional, but since I can only make a picture in three dimensions, I have to leave out one of the space dimensions because I need to include time. So here's a space-time picture. This is supposed to be a picture of the Earth at one time, this blue disk. It would be a sphere, but like I said, I have to leave out one space dimension. And as time goes on, the disk just persists in time. The Earth continues to exist, and it sweeps out this tube in space-time. Now, suppose I have an apple, like this one, and I hold it next to the Earth. It's in space-time. Here it is, and it's moving through time. Its distance from the Earth is remaining constant. That is, until I drop it. And its path in space-time goes like this, then. So this is an example of parallel lines, the line of the apple and the line of the Earth. These are lines in space-time, not lines in space, which were initially parallel but did not remain parallel. So that's basically what there is to the idea that space, that gravity is the curvature of space-time. So let's think about the case where the apple is thrown up and comes back down. That would look like this in space-time. The law of gravity that Einstein figured out is that the apple is actually following the straightest path it can in the curved space-time. In fact, just as a straight line, let's say on the Earth, if you're going from Santa Barbara to Moscow in a plane, to conserve fuel, you go on the shortest path. And that's the straightest line on the surface of the curved Earth. Similarly, in space-time, the apple goes on a special path from A to B. It's the straightest path, but it's not the shortest in time. It's actually the longest time, because time actually flows slower, lower in the gravitational field. This is really a mind-blowing fact. If I take two apples and I put a little clock in them and I synchronize the clock and I move this apple up here and then bring it back down and I compare the clocks, this clock will be behind because it stayed down. Time is running slower down here. Taller people get older faster.
Those apples are wearing Apple Watches.
So it's interesting to know how much slower. I mean, we didn't ever notice that, right? When you put your watch on your night table at night, you don't calculate carefully the height of your night table so that you know how to reset it in the morning. That's because it's a tiny effect at the surface of the Earth. It's 1 billionth of a second per year per foot at the Earth's surface. So if I take two watches, separate them by a foot, synchronize them perfectly, and wait 1 year, the one at the bottom will be 1/1,000,000,000th of a second behind. It's a tiny effect, but it's completely measurable. Today, it's actually measured in laboratories using atomic clocks on the surface of the Earth, and it's very noticeable for the global positioning system where you have large differences in height of the clocks on the satellites. Okay, so that's the background of general relativity. Now you know what general relativity is. It was confirmed at the time Einstein finally put the last pieces together in the puzzle. He confirmed the theory by a certain calculation. He explained an anomaly that didn't fit Newtonian gravity. It had been an outstanding anomaly for a long time. I'm not sure how many years, but roughly a century, maybe not quite. Sometime in the 1800s, it was recognized that the orbit of Mercury didn't quite fit Newton's theory of gravity. The problem was, the orbit of Mercury looks sort of like a spiral like this. So this blue dots are the closest point to the Sun on the orbit, and that position of that closest point is gradually rotating around like that. And it's possible to actually measure that position extremely accurately by using these transits. When Mercury passes in front of the face of the Sun, actually it's going in this direction, it's possible with the right filter, I guess, to see this little spot of Mercury blocking out the sunlight, and with very accurate clocks to measure precisely the time at which Mercury appears on the disk of the Sun. And because of that, it's possible to get extremely precise measurements on the orbit. And for that reason, it was known that by 43 seconds of arc per century, the movement of this blue point on the orbit was not agreeing with Newton's. Now let's just figure out how much that is, because I was astonished that that could be measured. A second of arc is a 60th of a 60th of a degree, and that's per century. So it works out to be about 9 minutes of advanced time for the transit per century. So you're watching it, you're waiting for Mercury to come by and for its little disk to appear in front of the Sun, and it gets there early, well, I don't know which direction we're facing, but in a different time, by 9 minutes per century. That means every decade it's about 1 minute, so you have to have clocks that are accurate to that accuracy and good observations of the transit. So the point here is that Einstein used his new theory to calculate the orbit and found that, sure enough, it predicted a tiny correction to Newton's theory, which exactly accounted for this 43 seconds of arc. He said he was trembling when he finished the calculation, that this theory, which was a profoundly different view of gravity, agreed with Newtonian gravity in almost every respect you could think of. And for this tiny deviation, it nailed it. Okay, so you might have thought, and Einstein thought, I think, that everything that the theory predicted would be just a tiny deviation from Newtonian physics. In fact, Einstein, to make that calculation, made an approximation. He just kept the first correction to Newtonian physics. It was all he needed. But this gentleman, Karl Schwarzschild, 1 year after Einstein finished the theory, found out that he could actually solve Einstein's equations exactly for the case of a spherically symmetric gravitational field, and he got a formula that describes the space-time geometry exactly, not approximately. Einstein was quite surprised that this was possible. It's actually a rather simple formula. For the scientist, that's just the line element on a sphere. R is the radial coordinate. T stands for some kind of time coordinate. And what this tells you is how much time passes in each location. It describes the path of light rays and distance measurements. There's something peculiar about this, which is called the Schwarzschild singularity. And this is where we finally first meet black holes. Notice it's just 1 year after Einstein completed the theory. So here we have something like 1 minus something called R sub S divided by R. Now, even non-mathematicians can tell that if you put R equal to R sub S, this becomes 1, and you have 1 minus 1, and that's 0. So there's a 0 multiplying this dt squared. And the physical meaning of that in the theory is that no time is passing. Something very strange in this formula. And over here, you're dividing by that, so it goes to infinity. It looked like a sick formula if you use it. And the people that discovered it, actually the same year another person did, Drosten in the Netherlands, both tried to kind of paper over this problem because it seemed clearly unphysical. I won't spend time now explaining how they did, but they had sort of spurious explanations of why you could ignore that. The true non-singular nature wasn't understood widely until 42 years later, but it was actually understood, what is that, later, not 20 years, but 16 years later, it's anything, so it's not such a great deal, but.
On the black hole, and that's the point at which our theory or our mathematics actually start to break down, which I think is what you're describing here, that it breaks down in the sense that it predicts certain phenomena that don't seem consistent. And so the concept that they have, that they're proposing is what did you call it, a firewall. I think that it's kind of easier to swallow if you say it's a point at which our expanded or more modern theory now reaches its limit.
Right.
And we're trying to reconcile the difficulties that come from where the mathematics breaks down, where the newer version of the mathematics breaks down.
The only problem with that explanation is that we do expect the breakdown that you're talking about at the singularity, in the center of the black hole. But that's separated from the horizon.
That's what I got.
So it's conceivable that somehow that region sort of grows up, blows up to a bigger region.
Or beyond the event horizon, then the mathematics breaks down to the point where it makes no sense to even think about one position versus another.
It's conceivable, but it's not, well, it's conceivable, but I don't think it's likely that the breakdown that we do expect, like you say, could make it out to the event horizon and resolve this particular puzzle. But that's not to say that people don't consider that. In fact, I just saw a paper today using string theory to potentially somehow combine the resolution of the physics at the singularity with the solution of this puzzle.
So Ted, at the beginning of your talk, you had nice examples of theory predicting observable phenomena.
Yeah.
Very beginning of talk. And then, of course, the last two-thirds,
right.
What would you tell the audience about, it's hard to know. This is the advantage of doing theories. We don't often burden ourselves with this question.
Well, we have the movie Interstellar, right? Can we use that?
That's right. But what do you see as, 20 years from now, what do you see coming that would, maybe potentially help resolve some of the mystery?
That is a tough question, Lars. I see this particular mystery stuck in the realm of theory for quite a while to come.
But in theory, if we got sensitive enough instruments to observe Hawking radiation, that would certainly be one step toward a better...
Potentially, and actually there was some idea that we might even see black holes and Hawking radiation at the LHC collider. If it were true that, some of the theoretical ideas that have been floated could potentially predict that. So, yeah, I guess something like that could happen conceivably. Then we would end up observing Hawking radiation and then maybe observe, actually learn something. It's not some, I can't say that, my choice to consider and think about this problem is not based on the hope for observational evidence within my lifetime.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Good job.